Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
While Governor Rick Scott is touting a new low crime rate, he's also raising concerns about what a budget cut to the Department of Corrections could mean for recidivism.
The reason why I asked for the money is because you go through and look at those programs, they work.
Also this week, a push from Florida Democrats to get more education funding this year is not likely to move forward, as Republicans maintain schools have the funds they need.
Our school systems around the state are sitting on $2 billion of cash.
We'll also get a heads up about how to avoid falling victim to fraud this hurricane season, and we'll look into efforts across the state to recognize and remember those who have served our country in the armed forces. I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. Governor Rick Scott is touting a 47-year low in the state's crime rate after the Florida Department of Law Enforcement released its annual statistics. Ryan Daly reports the governor said he's disappointed in the legislature over the cuts to the Department of Corrections.
The governor's mansion sits in Leon County, which has topped the state in per capita crime since 2015. Yet this year, most major crime metrics are falling in Leon. Despite its efforts, the county hasn't shifted in the rankings, partially due to a high bar being set around the state.
That's a moving target each year that the state improves, because they had a better starting point than we are, since we started at what you might call a deficit.
That's Leon Sheriff Walt McNeil. He's measuring his agency's progress against what amounted to a 4.5% drop in total crime around the state and a 6% decrease in crime per capita. But it was in Northeast Florida where Governor Rick Scott stood beside Jacksonville's mayor and sheriff as he announced the statistics.
I want to thank Sheriff Williams and Mayor Curry for the opportunity to be here and announce that in our state, we're now at a 47-year low in our crime rate.
The Uniform Crime Report statistics compiled by the FBI track crimes under the categories of murder, aggravated assault, rape, robbery, larceny, burglary, and motor vehicle theft. Of those categories statewide, only recorded rapes saw an increase of about 4% to a total of 7,934. The report even records weapons used in different criminal categories. The use of guns is down nearly 7% in murders and 11% in robberies, but were used more often in aggravated assault and rapes. Leon Sheriff McNeil says the yearly numbers can be a barometer for how respective agencies are doing. So, what's working and what's not? In Duval County, where Scott touted crime stats, total crime was stagnant year over year and saw a minuscule drop per capita. That's despite adding a significant number of police over the past couple of years, according to Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry.
The reason we, working with the sheriff, have added 180 police officers over the last three budgets, 2 years in Jacksonville, and brought back community service officers and invested in technology to get the bad guys off the street is because public safety is our top priority.
Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams acknowledged Duval, which ranks third in the state in crime rate, isn't keeping up with falling rates around Florida.
And the state numbers show us where we should be, and where we, you know, that's our goal, to be moving in the direction and trending. You know, again, while we have some momentum here, our numbers don't reflect the state numbers.
While Duval County's beefing up of law enforcement hasn't yielded a significant impact, Leon recently debuted an expanded partnership between state agencies and a number of sheriff's departments in the region that officials say is producing results. Second Judicial Circuit State Attorney Jack Campbell praised the effectiveness of agencies banding together.
And law enforcement is going to have a unified effort so that wherever the criminals want to run, wherever they want to hide, we are going to beat the bushes and we're going to put them in prison. And we're going to make this community a safe place so that these statistics will continue to come down.
Leon Sheriff's Office based the new effort on the success of its All In program. Debuted in 2017, it bolstered its partnership with Florida Highway Patrol, resulting in the agency seizing more than $900,000 in contraband and assets from criminals during a four-month period. But it isn't just policing practices that factor into crime as a whole. Recidivism is something state leaders, including Governor Scott, keep an eye on. While the recidivism rate is currently trending down, according to Scott, he says he is concerned funding shortfalls from this past session could hurt that. Asked about the Department of Corrections' nearly $30 million cut in funding that has affected mental health services, Scott seemed to place blame squarely on legislators.
I've asked for, over the last eight budgets, I think it's almost $400 million more than what the legislature has funded. The process is I get to propose a budget, and then the legislature decides what they're going to put into it. The Department of Correction is working hard. Our recidivism rate is down. As you know, our crime rate is down. I'm disappointed the legislature didn't fund all of it.
Scott said he believes DOC programs like those geared toward mental health are effective.
The reason why I asked for the money is because you go through and look at those programs, they work. You know, we've made significant impacts, our investments in reentry programs in the state, and it's worked.
Attorney General Pam Bondi, in a statement regarding the lowered statistics, gave a reminder that five law enforcement officers have died in the line of duty so far this year. In April, a ceremony was held at the Capitol to remember the 10 officers who died in 2017 and four more whose deaths in the past were recently discovered. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
A special session to address education funding this year doesn't appear likely. Florida Democrats gained enough support to cause the Florida Secretary of State to pull members of the legislature on their interest in a session, but that effort fell short. In the House, only 41 lawmakers voted in favor of the proposal. That's out of 105 members responding to Secretary of State Ken Detzner's query. Meanwhile, of 29 Senate respondents, just 16 said they'd support a special session. A 3/5 majority from both chambers would have been required to trigger the assembly. West Park Democratic Representative Chevron Jones is one of the lawmakers who pushed for the special session.
I really believe that we are at a pivotal moment to where we really need to take a look at this education budget and do what we know needs to be done to save our public education system here within the state of Florida.
Jones says the state's public schools don't have enough money to get by while they wait for lawmakers to hammer out a new budget during the next regular session.
Over a dozen school districts have already had to go out for a referendum in order to be able to pay for teacher salaries, to be able to pay for gifted programs, after-school programming.
But legislative leaders are touting record-breaking education funding this year, and the state's Republican leadership has pushed back against claims that schools have been left without the funds they need. During a recent press conference, Governor Rick Scott told reporters K-12 education has seen a $4.5 billion increase.
Our school systems around the state are sitting on $2 billion of cash. Whether it's our per pupil funding, whether it's the funding we put in for law enforcement, we are going to continue, as governor, I'll continue to fight for more money for education.
And Scott says from his view, the current school funding plan in Florida is working.
We were the only state that had significant student achievement gains last year in the entire country. It's because we have an accountable system, we've put more dollars into it, but we put it in a manner that we get a return.
Meanwhile, Miami Democratic Representative Nicholas Duran says while he acknowledges more money in total is going to schools this year, lawmakers earmarked a large chunk of that money for school safety following the Parkland school shooting. He says not enough is left over for education.
This is not what we intended. This is certainly not what I intended when I voted for this bill, and this is absolutely not what school districts across the state wanted or expected. We must make this right. And that's why over 30 of our colleagues joined Chevron and I, me, in making this request. That's why we are here today urging the rest of the legislature to follow suit and call us back to session to fix this.
About a dozen Republicans in the House and 10 Republicans from the Senate did not respond to the Secretary of State's poll. In a statement following the results, Jones threw some barbs at a few of the members who did not vote, saying Florida's traditional public schools are, in his words, suffering, while some members focus on their efforts to reach higher office. still to come on Capitol Report. As hurricane season quickly approaches, officials are urging Florida residents to get prepared, and part of that preparation includes knowing how to identify and avoid fraud, which officials say often runs rampant after a storm.
You know, you give them $500 up front, and then that's the last time you see them and your cash money.
And as we prepare to honor America's fallen service members, we also get ready to recall the event that set the stage for the Allied victory in World War II.
D-Day was the long-awaited second front that the Soviet Union was desperate for the Western Allies, Great Britain, and the United States to open.
While the first named storm churns toward Florida, an early hurricane season appears to be underway. Officials are warning the damage from storms is often compounded by fraud cases following the storm. NOAA Hertz reports hurricane fraud is a widespread concern throughout the state.
The devastation that hurricanes bring can ravage communities and cripple infrastructure. But for many, the problems continue long after the storm. John Moore, the press secretary for the Chief Financial Officer of Florida, Jimmy Petronis, explains what the fraud can look like.
Well, what we've seen, it can be as simple as fly-by-night contractor coming into a community offering to provide repairs at a discounted rate, sometimes a cash-only discounted rate. You know, you give them $500 up front, and then that's the last time you see them and your cash money. If any contractor or restoration professional offers to waive a deductible or discount your deductible, that is against the law, and that is insurance fraud.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, CFO Petronis established the Disaster Fraud Action Strike Team. Think of them as the Avengers of fighting hurricane fraud. But Moore says following the last hurricane season, the team was up to its neck in fraud tips.
There really wasn't anybody in the state who didn't at least feel some sort of effect from Irma. So I don't want to say an uptick in fraud, but we have seen a lot of tips come to our fraud tip hotline. We received just under 500 tips. In the Tampa and Orlando area alone, we had about 100, just over 100 cases open.
So how can people avoid fraud following a hurricane? Sometimes the fastest fix can seem like the best. But president of the Tallahassee Builders Association, Doug Barton, says no matter how bad the situation, it's important to take a few minutes to follow three simple steps.
Make sure they're licensed by going to the Department of Business and Professional Regulation website. Find out if indeed they are licensed and if they have complaints against them. Number two, make sure they have liability insurance and workers' comp insurance. Three, you never give money down. In our industry, that's probably the biggest red flag out there. They don't have the funds to carry the job. They probably shouldn't be in the business.
Barton says another common risk following a storm is price gouging.
People are in such a dire need to protect their home, and so these people are gouging. We've had that in large instance on the last two storms. It's very difficult to curtail that activity as they aren't licensed, and it's hard to determine whether they are price gouging.
One defense against price gouging is the Attorney General's price gouging hotline at 1-866-966-7226. When it comes to staying safe and protecting yourself and your neighbors from fraud, Press Secretary Moore says it all comes back to alerting the authorities with the fraud tip hotline.
I can't nail it down enough. Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Petronis has really made an effort to turn up awareness and protect consumers before and after storms. And moving forward, you know, a strong, educated, and aware community is a safe community. If you hear of or see any activity that just doesn't seem right or is too good to be true, give us a call, 1-800-378-0445.
The Attorney General's office also recommends prepping by stocking up and planning ahead for emergency situations. Preparing for a storm also means preparing for the aftermath. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Noah Hertz.
May is Lupus Awareness Month. Allison Wyman is the executive director of the Big Bend Area Health Education Center and the Big Bend Rural Health Network, which serves several counties in the state of Florida. She spoke with Florida Public Radio's Sasha Cordner about how her group is working toward a statewide initiative to get more data on lupus and bring more awareness to the hard-to-diagnose disease.
First off, what is lupus?
So lupus is an autoimmune disease that disproportionately affects women, particularly minority women. And it can be very difficult to diagnose because the range of symptoms is so broad. So many times it'll go undiagnosed for years and years. And the sooner people get treatment, the better their outcomes. So there's really a push to raise lupus awareness and to really get information about lupus out into the community so people know to see their doctors and to start talking about it and maybe suspect lupus if they're having some of the symptoms.
Now, you were saying it was a wide range of symptoms. Can you give some examples?
Sure. So lupus can affect pretty much every system of the body. Some of the common symptoms are the butterfly rash across the face. People that have lupus usually have sun sensitivity. It can infect their kidneys. It can impact their mental capabilities. Fatigue is a very common symptom of lupus. And many days they just wake up really, really tired and, just not feeling well.
I know the Big Bend Rural Health Network hosted a summit some time ago.
We did.
How were you able to do something like that, and is there anything you're working on now?
We received a grant that allowed us to have some guest speakers and to invite various people from the community and talk about lupus. And from that, we've established some great partnerships moving forward. We're working very closely with the Department of Health to really start collecting better data on lupus because it is so hard to diagnose and goes undiagnosed for years. Sometimes it's hard to really get a true prevalence rate of lupus. So we're working with them in collecting better data and then also just getting the message out about what lupus is, who's impacted, and some resources for people that might be affected by lupus.
And the data you're working on, is it just for the counties in the Panhandle, or is it for the whole of Florida?
No, this is for all of Florida. We're working on having lupus added into the Behavioral Factor Risk Surveillance Survey that CDC and DOH puts out. So we'll be asking individuals that take part of the survey, have you been diagnosed with lupus? Is one thing we're doing. And then we're also getting it lupus statewide. We're having schools collect information on children that may be reporting lupus. Their parents report lupus. It's like a checklist when you start school. They ask you a whole host of conditions. Do you have diabetes? Do you have this? Do you have that? And we're having lupus added to that list. And then also at the end of the year, that will be reported to the Department of Health so we can start to get an idea of the prevalence of young lupus sufferers.
Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
I think it's just really important for people to pay attention to any sort of, lupus, like I said, is really tricky to diagnose. And so just by being aware of the symptoms of lupus and getting not only individuals but physicians to think that lupus may be a possibility. Lupus mimics a lot of other autoimmune diseases, but also some common, who doesn't wake up tired, So, but I think it's just important to continue to try to educate the population to try to raise awareness of lupus so people can get diagnosed and start treatment earlier.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Sure.
That was Florida Public Radio's Sasha Cordner speaking with Allison Wyman, Executive Director of the Big Bend Rural Health Network. On Monday, the nation observes Memorial Day and honors all those who have died in the course of military service. A week and a half later, the world will mark the 74th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy, which is remembered as D-Day. Tom Flanagan spoke with Kurt Peeler, Associate Professor of History and Director of the World War II Institute at Florida State University, about this pivotal point in the conflict.
Then on the 5th day of June 1944, just as you see them here, a fleet of more than 4,000 ships put out from England. This was D-Day, fourth anniversary of the Battle of Dunkirk, and the Allied armies were striking back.
Of course, the actual landing would come the following day, June 6th. But before we delve into why D-Day was so important, Professor Kurt Peeler is quick to stress that this was not the first invasion of Allied forces into Axis-held territory.
There were other D-Days, particularly in Europe. There was the Operation Torch in North Africa. There was the invasion of Sicily. There was the invasion of Italy. There was the second invasion of Italy, the effort to do sort of a run around the Germans at Anzio. But D-Day was the ultimate of amphibious assaults.
Just the raw numbers connected with the operation surpassed anything ever seen before. The total number of Allied troops in the invasion topped 156,000. They came aboard nearly 7,000 ships and more than 2,000 aircraft. Given that very few of those who actually took part in the D-Day operation are still alive, the primary way we know about the event is through the movies. And Professor Peeler says two films in particular have portrayed it well from a historical perspective.
There's a lot I loved about Steven Spielberg's film, Saving Private Ryan. What gets missing, though, is the big picture, which I think that is captured by The Longest Day, that this was very much an Allied operation. And if you tour the beaches, if you're fortunate enough to tour the beaches, you get a real appreciation, particularly of not only the American role, but also of the British and particularly Canadian role.
Although Peeler says the Allied nation that really benefited from the invasion wasn't even present on the beaches of Normandy.
D-Day was the long-awaited second front that the Soviet Union was desperate for the Western Allies, Great Britain and the United States, to open. The United States, Franklin Roosevelt and Army Chief of Staff George Marshall would have liked to have opened it in 1942, and it kept getting pushed back.
But Peeler notes that nearly two-year delay actually was a good thing for the invading forces.
The British and the Americans were really fortunate never to confront the bulk of the German army, that the Soviet Union's from June of 1941, when they were invaded, till the war ends, confronts the bulk of the German army. And that's why for Americans, it's the good war, because if we had lost millions of men and women, we would not consider it the good war. We might consider it the Great Patriotic War, but definitely not the good war.
Even so, things were bloody enough, especially on the American landing beach called Omaha, where nearly 4,000 troops were killed.
Part of it was the most heavily defended, but there were flaws in the planning and debates. The British thought there should be much more shelling of the beaches, and they ended up having a compromise. The result is the bombers drop too far away from the targets, and there's not enough shelling to do appreciable damage in Omaha Beach to the very entrenched Germans. And the result is high loss of life. Omar Bradley thought he might have to abandon the assault. But in the end, they're partly saved by the Navy. The Navy, four destroyers, they almost beached themselves to level devastating fire at German emplacements.
Professor Peeler says there are many little-known D-Day stories, some not yet part of the event's formal history, awaiting the curious at FSU's Institute on World War II and the human experience.
The two joys of it is we have thousands of collections, which we're stewarding, but one of my pleasures is to try to get scholars and students in the general public to know about us and to use our great holdings. And among the great holdings, we have some wonderful materials on D-Day.
Which took place 74 years ago, this Wednesday, June 6th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, reporter Bobby O'Brien takes us to the Bay Pines National Cemetery in St. Petersburg for a remembrance of veterans who have died, but with no family by their side.
It's called an unattended interment. There's no service, no ceremony. Just two VA workers with the remains of a 72-year-old Vietnam veteran in a rectangular metal box. Armed with a drill and clipboard, cemetery worker Terry Clark unfastens the stone covering of a niche at the outdoor columbarium. There are rows and rows of long granite walls, each with more than 200 nooks to hold veterans' ashes.
Right now we're making sure that once we open the niche cover that everything's clean inside.
Clark checks his paperwork with the cemetery director, Eugenia Simmons. They verify the veteran's name before sliding in the metal box and resealing the opening. Simmons signs a form and reaches out, gently patting the stone.
Whenever I do an interment, somebody has to say goodbye.
she's bidding farewell to Clifford Leo Bissick. He was a sergeant in the Army during the Vietnam era and later served in the Navy. 8 years ago, the Tampa resident briefly became a local hero when he foiled a drugstore robbery, chasing away the thief with his cane. In March, Bissick died of heart disease. He was found sitting outside the Tampa motel room where he lived. Inside his room, police discovered old paperwork from the VA, but he had no close relatives. So the medical examiner sent Bissick's cremated remains to the nearest VA cemetery, Bay Pines. Simmons says because Florida has so many retirees, it's common for veterans to die with no family or no relatives nearby.
We place them, we give them a dignified burial, and then once the cremated remains are placed, we send information to the family so that they know how to locate their loved one.
Under federal law, every eligible veteran is entitled to a military funeral if the family requests it. When there is no family present, the veteran can still be interred, but without an individual ceremony. The VA does not track the number of unattended burials nationally, but at Bay Pines, a group of volunteers tries to make sure that even those veterans who lack close family get the recognition they deserve. Once a month, they gather to pay tribute to all of them. Marine veteran Bob Cannon has organized every service for nearly two decades.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. When I came back, let's say I had not a very good welcome home. And this is what we're trying to do. Make sure that everybody, they get a good welcome and send off.
The send-off at Bay Pines is held the first Tuesday of every month. It starts with a motorcycle ride-by with Randall McNabb as the ride captain.
And I love these guys. You know, they spend their own time and their own dime to get out here and stand for these veterans.
The service is brief. It includes a prayer, color guard, and the reading of the deceased veterans' names, followed by the ringing of a bell, a Navy tradition.
Clifford Bissick, United States Navy.
Bill Conum, the commander of the Clearwater Marine League's Color Guard, says it's important to him to be here for his comrades, just as he hopes someone will be here for him.
I don't really think about them not having anyone around because we're here. And we'll always be here.
I'm making you choke up a little bit?
Yes, ma'am.
Typically at military funerals, the color guard presents a folded American flag to the veteran's family. But here, the flag was symbolically handed to a volunteer. Then it will be used again at next month's ceremony. I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Tom Flanagan. A special thanks to WUSF's Bobby O'Brien. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Regan McCarthy. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport, and please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.